The MIT Media Lab was created 25 years ago as a place where scientists and businesses could achieve mutually beneficial goals. Companies were given radical ideas that frequently opened new markets in places they had never considered, while scientists received funding along with practical application of their work. Today, the lab brings together specialists across a wide range of fields, among them neuroscience, child psychology, and even music. Former Media Lab director Frank Moss has written a book called The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices about the work being done at the Media Lab. It's published by Crown Business, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Moss to our show today. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here, Leonard.
Does the Media Lab have a mission statement?
There are really two things that govern the work that goes on at the Media Lab. I'm not sure you'd call it a mission, but maybe you'd call it a credo. That is, any research that's done there can improve our lives in the future in one way, in some way. So we don't necessarily think about, you know, building faster chips or faster networks. We think about how technology will impact our everyday lives in the future. That's number one. And number two, it's got to be things that are not being done elsewhere.
But why call it a Media Lab, which would suggest newspapers, magazines, radio, TV, and the new internet media?
I was asked that almost every day for 5 years, and there's not a simple answer other than when the Media Lab began back in the mid-1980s, the founders, Jerome Wiesner and Nicholas Negroponte, predicted the convergence of media around digital technology, newspapers, computers, and television. And that was the theme that drove the lab in the early years, and people were excited and interested about. As time went on, of course, the interpretation of media really became digital technology, but that name was known throughout the world. In fact, in Asia, people know the word Media Lab better than MIT.
Mm. Well, of course, the old-fashioned media, much of the old-fashioned media are suffering these days, so maybe you'll keep the word alive, if nothing else. You talked about an intersection. You write about the intersection between work and fun in the lab. Why is that intersection so important?
Well, it really is all about the ideas behind how innovation can really occur in a way that unleashes the creativity and the passion of individuals. And one of the early professors at the lab, Professor Seymour Papert, studied children and how they created and learned even in kindergarten. And he discovered by watching them that they learned by creating and building. And he tried to bring to the lab, not just for kindergartners, but for graduate students, the idea that you're going to learn about technology by actually building things rather than just thinking about them. So it's fun, but it's hard, and it's often called kind of playful invention, and that kind of playful invention that is the same way kids work with blocks and build castles, and it falls down and they learn from that, occurs every day at the Media Lab.
And it seems like a place where no one is doing what they're good at. Is that what is meant by an anti-disciplinary approach?
Well, I think it's a place where everyone does a lot of things, and I think what they are good at is doing a lot of things. You know, there is represented within the lab a wide variety of disciplines among individuals. As you mentioned earlier, musicians, neuroscientists, computer scientists, engineers, designers, artists, and many people are good at three or four of those. But the most important thing is bringing those all together in a way that can create a cross-fertilization of ideas that recognizes a simple fact, that the challenges of the 21st century are not going to be solved by the discipline and silos of the 20th. We've got to move across disciplines to find the solutions to the key problems that confront society today and in the future.
You mentioned one of the founders, Seymour Papert. What did he mean when he said, "We are all disabled"?
Well, he studied learning in children and studied learning disabilities. And what he discovered is that, you know, although there may be children with more profound learning disabilities, perhaps neurological disorders, that we all have shortcomings in how we learn. They're just different. And so he began by understanding that we're all disabled in some way in terms of how we learn, but then he generalized it. You take mobility. Well, someone who loses their lower limbs in Afghanistan or Iraq is mobility disabled. But as we age, we all become mobility disabled. So take any disability, and we all have it to one degree or another.
Well, marketers sort of work off of that concept of us being disabled. our eyes are too small, our feet aren't pretty, whatever. Aren't you dealing with that kind of stuff as well?
Well, it's nothing to be ashamed about, for sure. I think the power we're able to tap into by recognizing this fact is that when you develop technologies for people who are disabled, say people with autism or amputees or people with Alzheimer's disease, you then notice, and we have at the lab, that those technologies apply to almost everyone. And I can give you a very simple example. Professor Roz Picard developed a social-emotional prosthetic for people with autism that enables them to image the face of the person they're talking to and understand their emotions and decode them. So I'm speaking to you now. If you were nodding off, I know that you were bored. If you're smiling as you are now, you're happy, or if you're perplexed. And I can understand that now as an autistic person. Marketeers from companies in the lab noticed that and said, what if I could use the same technology to understand how our customers are reacting emotionally to our products? And the power that we're tapping into here is the ability to do good by working with people with these disabilities, but then seeing that there can be financial growth coming out of those. That's a change that really reverses the order in which technology has been developed in the past.
Didn't you study aeronautics?
I studied aeronautical engineering.
Hadn't the space race cooled down by the mid-70s when you graduated? Was there still much work for people in the field?
By the time I graduated in 1976, PhDs in aeronautical engineering were pumping Tasty Freeze in California.
And you wound up in what you call the computer game.
Well, during the time that I was at MIT doing work in aeronautical engineering, I was using computers as a number of during the 1970s, we noticed that computers were good at helping us do aeronautical engineering or physics or chemistry. And so by the time I got out, I was proficient with computers, and that's all I knew. So I had to find the job in what I knew, and it was computers. And so I went to IBM Research early on.
Of course, computers were very different in those days.
They were big. I'll never forget. And we also coded on punch cards. And young people don't even know what they are nowadays. But I remember when I was helping out with the Apollo 13 crisis. I happened to be at MIT at the time that the Apollo 13 crisis occurred, and MIT was involved with the guidance and control systems. And they had me running the punch cards from one floor to another as a graduate student. And I tripped going down the stairs, and the punch cards cascaded down. Fortunately, they had a backup set of punch cards. But who would think of a backup set of punch cards today?
They were all out of order, and that would have driven the computer crazy?
Well, we had three astronauts whose lives were at stake, and I was going, oh, my God, I think I've killed them. But I got upstairs, and I was sweating very hard, and they said, no, no worry. We always have a backup because people like you often trip on the stairs.
Well, how did you wind up becoming an entrepreneur?
Well, I began in research at IBM, and what I noticed was that the time it took from my research ideas to get into a product that people were actually using was sometimes 10 years, and that was frustrating. I really wanted to make things happen, and so I tried to make it happen at IBM, and I think I broke a lot of glass by trying to push very hard on how much needed to be understood. And after a couple of frustrating years at that, I got approached by a startup company called Apollo Computer, and I was actually using their computers at IBM, and I left and I went to that company.
And the world has changed a lot. Now IBM would be encouraging people to think outside the box. But in those days, I suspect everybody said, we're doing great. The Xerox machines are working fine. No need to worry about that. So just let's keep on doing what we do.
Well, the worst thing that happens is when you experience success and the world changes. And I think IBM was in that situation, but IBM has changed considerably. I actually went back to IBM later in my career after I created a company that was bought by IBM. And by that time, they had me back because they wanted to have me serve as a catalyst for change within IBM. And today, IBM is one of the most innovative corporations in the world.
How did you wind up with the Media Lab?
Well, I just mentioned the company Tivoli Systems that we started back in the early 1990s in Austin, Texas. And this was my chance to run a company, and I did. Austin was terrific. The company worked out well. I took it public, but then I sold it to IBM, stayed on for a couple of years in the 90s, and came back to Boston, and I got interested in what was being done with the human genome and computers. My mom always wanted me to be a real doctor. She never understood what an aeronautical engineer had to do with. All her friends had sons who were real doctors.
You could have called yourself doctor if you wanted to.
I did. I had a PhD, but my mom was like, you're not a real doctor. And my friend's sons and daughters are doctors. But at any rate, I got involved with computers and the human genome and actually ended up co-founding a drug discovery company in the early 2000s called Infinity Pharmaceuticals, bringing my knowledge of computers now to the science and the practice of discovering drugs. And that was fun and terrific. By 2005, we'd taken the company public and three drugs in clinical trial. And I got a call from a headhunter. Said, how would you like to be director of the MIT Media Lab? And I said, I'm good. But I was convinced to take they convinced me to take a trip down to the lab. It was only 20 minutes from home. I actually took my daughter, Marissa, and her husband, Mike, there on a weekend. And they were looking around with me, and they said, if you don't take this job, this is so cool, we're going to disown you.
My guest is Frank Moss, the former director of the MIT Media Lab. He was there from 2006 through 2011. He's written a book called The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices. So how does this is MIT. This is a university. How does it work? Are we talking about a classroom situation here, a laboratory within the university, or something totally different?
Something totally different. It was actually created by Jerome Wiesner, who was then retired president of MIT in 1985. And Jerome Wiesner partnered up with a young professor in architecture named Nicholas Negroponte, and they said, let's reinvent how research is done in universities. Wiesner had been a science advisor to Kennedy and actually a proponent of nuclear disarmament. And I think he definitely was forward-looking, and he said, the research that occurs in silos in the university, in computer science and social sciences and electrical engineering, is not going to serve the purposes of the 21st century. So let's create a place where we put all these people together in one building, computer scientists, electrical engineers, musicians, and so forth, and then let them invent and create according to their passions.
And are we talking about teachers and students? Or are we just
teachers and students. Mm-hmm. So these are professors who are experts in their field of artificial intelligence or robots or human-computer interface. They each have about 4, 5, or 6 students who are their apprentices. So the teachers are the sorcerers, if you will. And they transfer or transmit their knowledge to the apprentices by actually thinking and doing and building things. So the Media Lab is a place where things get built.
And who pays for all of this?
Corporate sponsors. And this was the brilliance, I think.
Now, are they paying for things that you will then supply them with? Because one of the big issues over the years has been who gets the money from the development. Is it the university? Is it the person who paid for the research? How does it work at the MIT Media Lab?
Think of it as a collaborative or a condo. There are about 60 sponsors of the lab. They're corporate sponsors. They each pay a subscription fee to be members, like it's a country club. And in return for that fee, the annual fee, they get access to all the ideas and intellectual property that are developed at the lab during the period of time. So it's a sharing. It's a sharing among them. They're like creating a collaborative where they all gain. It's the rising tide lifts all boats idea.
Now, let's talk about some of the things that you write about here. Professor Deb Roy's Speech Home Project. Didn't he wire his house with 3,000 feet of cable, 11 video cameras, and 14 microphones?
He did. And when I first met Professor Roy, I call him Deb, we're actually partners now in a company that derived from that. I told him he was crazy, and a lot of people told him he was crazy. And, you know, what he was interested in was a simple thing. He wanted to learn how his child learned his first word. And so he instrumented his house with cameras in every room, and the minute he and his wife brought his son home, they sent the cameras rolling and recorded more video and audio than has practically been accumulated in any one spot other than YouTube.
Was he concerned about the effect it might have on the development of his newborn son, and not to mention his relationship with his wife?
Well, he was always quick to point out that on each wall in his house, he had a cutoff switch. And so when they walked in a room and didn't want to be videotaped, he could cut it off. His wife is also, she's a developmental psychologist, so they were in this project together, which I think helped. And I think he was very concerned and actually talked a lot about the fact that his son would have ownership of the data.
So is that the case? His
yes,
son
it
owns
is.
It
is. He created, well, his son, you know, until the age of 18, Deb, of course, as and his wife have the ability, the parental guidance here. But his son literally owns the information and data. But I think he was concerned, and he certainly tried to make it as inconspicuous for his son and his development as he possibly could. And his son, I think, developed quite well.
Well, I would be concerned about Dr. John Moore's work, Collaborithm. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Well, you're talking about an area that I have great passion for. Dr. John Moore is my student. I run a group called New Media Medicine at the lab. After about 2 years at the lab, I decided that I wanted to have my own research group. This hard fun looked like too much fun. And I had a real passion coming out of the drug discovery game for what technology could do for empowering patients. So my belief, and I share it very strongly with Dr. John Moore and my students, is that the most underutilized resource in the healthcare system is patients. We vastly underestimate the power that you and I have to understand our medical conditions and to take steps. So John, as we call him, is developing a platform that enables you and I to actually collaborate at home or in the doctor's office with a doctor on a peer-to-peer basis. No more high priest and serf relationship. We're on an equal basis with doctors.
Well, what bothered me, I'm quoting you, you write, it will soon be possible to monitor and record nearly everything about our lives, including our vital signs, what we eat, how many calories we burn, what we buy, whom we speak to on a daily basis, and even the tone of voice while doing so. Well, some people might find that scarily intrusive.
Well, look, that's what's happening. That's not what Dr. John Moore or, or myself or anyone at the lab is making happen. It's simply true, and you read about it a lot today, they call it big data, that everything about technology now is creating a cloud of information around us. Now, big companies could potentially use that to understand and market to you and make you buy things you don't want to and understand things about you that you don't want. But our view is, wouldn't it be great if individuals could use the data about themselves to improve their lives? So that's our slant on it.
We have very little time left, but can you tell us a bit about Nexi and Huggable?
Well, Professor Cynthia Bazile is one of the world's experts in sociable robots. You know, we're familiar with robots that clean your floor or robots that are in the back room that do assembly and manufacturing plants. She builds humanoid robots that actually connect with human beings on an emotional basis. And why that's important is it makes the human being want to actually teach the robot like the robot were a young child. And we talk about artificial intelligence and Watson, the big computer. Well, you could never program a computer with everything it needs to know about people. But if you make it sociable, then people will want to teach it. And that's what happens with Nexi.
So this is a robot standing in for our child and our pet.
It could be much more. It could actually help older people, be a companion in assisted living facilities. It could help people with their medications. It could actually be a companion to a young child in a hospital who can't have a pet. I mean, there are many roles that are going to be played by these sociable robots that are not the, you know, the typical roles that we think of in science fiction movies.
Frank Moss is the former director of the MIT Media Lab. His book, The Sorcerers and Their Apprentices, is published by Crown Business. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a real pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.